Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. And today I am here with Davida Breyer, who is the author of Sinkhole, her first novel. Davida, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to talk to you today.
Could you start out by sharing a little bit like the synopsis of this novel and what it is about?
Sure. It's a bit of a crossover, but it is a suspenseful coming-of-age novel immersed in the 1980s in Central Florida. The main character has been living in exile for 15 years, and she's called home. And in coming home, and that home is a tiny, tiny hometown in Central Florida called Lareda, she's forced to confront the death of her best friend. But in confronting that, she begins to realize that maybe some of what she believed wasn't true. It's a little coming of age. It's a little suspense. It's a little Southern Gothic.
It's a little bit of everything. So this is your debut novel, but you have been writing for a long time. You've been writing zines for a long time. And one of the things you did was create a zine talking about, I'm holding it up, creating a zine talking about creating this novel. Could you talk a little bit about, before we get into the novel, that process of what it was like to have been writing for a long time, but then sitting down and saying, okay, I want to do this larger project, this new project, and what that was like for you?
I've been publishing zines since 1995. And largely, they've all been either review zines or essay-driven, usually, you know, personal zines or thematic, I'll edit. And this was a very, very different project. But I approached it like I do most things, with a deadline, and decided that if I was going to do this, I could give myself a year to do it and just try. And it might be horrible, it might not, but I kind of stumbled about trying to figure out the best way that I would work. And so I spent that year figuring out not just the characters, but the process.
So you start this, and what's interesting about this is the novel, like you said, is set in Florida. And could you talk a little bit, and it's also set in Florida in the 1980s and also in 2001. So it's not present day Florida. So why Florida? Like, what was the choice of setting this in Florida? What was it about Florida that really sort of drew you into this as a setting and for these characters?
So I grew up in South Florida. And when I was thinking about these characters, what they go through, I kind of wanted to show some of that duality of Florida. And there are multiple dualities. There is, of course, the easy duality that you can see in the novel that pertains to class. And there is the Florida that a lot of people know, the beaches, you know, that rich part of Florida. And then there is a very poor part that you don't really know unless you experience. I also wanted to show some of the duality that I think that if you've never really seen Florida as a local, that it's a bit of a joke. There's Florida Man, there's Ridiculous Wildlife, things want to kill you, politics want to kill you. You know, Florida is a difficult place, but there is also great beauty in Florida that is not only overlooked, but actively destroyed by people who don't see it. And when we, you know, when you look at all of the, of just the buildup, the draining of the glades, the allowing Big Sugar to do what it wants, and just the, you know, the way that a lot of the southern part of the state has been overbuilt. And we see some of the problems in that when we get hurricanes in the area, but what about the beauty? What about what was there? And in a sense, setting the book in the 1980s allowed me to isolate my characters in a time and a place before the internet, before cell phones, before social media, and put these kids in a small town in an isolated time. But it also allowed me to show a time and a place too, when that wild part of Florida was still wild. While we had damage and there was a lot that had been done to the state, you know, more harm has been done, had been done in those years and since to the environment.
Right. And one of the things that I thought was great was that two of your main characters spend a lot of time out in nature, right? They have this tree that they spend time in. And so can you talk a little bit about that choice of having them really being a part of this kind of that nature and in Florida and what that means?
I spent a lot of time as a kid in trees in Florida. I mean, if you're in a tiny town like that, there aren't a ton of places to hang out. A tree makes as much sense as anything. But again, you see of the three main characters, there is generally the consumption and, you know, sitting in a house when you're with the, you know, the antagonist, and everything is kind of that construct. But Michelle and Morris and the other two characters do spend their time in this tree, and their friendship is very organic. Their attempts at who they're trying to be is very organic. And there's kind of that difference in that, you know, maybe what is pure, for want of a better word, in trying to figure things out, and then all of the layers of social construct around it that confuses everything.
And setting this, so let's talk about these, especially our three sort of main characters. You have this setting, and setting this in the 1980s also allows you to have them think about issues of sexuality and sexual identity in ways that is a little more nuanced than it is now, right? In different ways. But your main character, Michelle, so can you talk a bit about her and how you found her as a character and who she is?
Michelle, as she began to develop as a character, I began to realize that she was asexual. And it also, you know, it further drives home this friendship and the depth of the friendship and the importance of the friendship she has with Morrison. Only it is the 1980s. And she knows she's not like the other kids, but she doesn't know how she is. She doesn't really understand what that means. She just knows that's who she is, and she doesn't have a word for it. Much in the same way, you know, the other characters understand their sexual identities. And they're figuring that out at a time when there wasn't a lot of support for teens, especially teens in a small town. And trying to figure that out in its own way, that is this underlying daily danger that particularly Morrison faces. And so there's the, you know, in the book, there's the murder, there's other stuff, there's things going on, but just, I also wanted to talk about the daily dangers and things that kids were facing then as they are now, just in different ways.
Right. And that I appreciated too, that it's not always like this clear cut kind of thing, right? Just because you are rich, it doesn't mean that you have X, Y, and Z dangers, or because you're poor, you have these other X, Y, and Z dangers. And so there's a lot of complexity with these characters too, and with their family lives and what that looks like. So let's talk a little bit about maybe Morrison. And so Morrison is this, your character who he's gay, right? It's really hard. He's also doesn't know who his dad is, single mom. So could you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, and Morrison, again, he's, you can kind of see where with the characters, there's a lot in the book that has to do with both absent and present fathers. And so there are a lot of, there are, you know, as many that are absent, there are as many that are present. For Morrison, he is figuring out who he is, and he is introduced to a lot of things from, you know, the books he reads, the men his mother dates. He, you know, he has a love of nature. He has a love of punk. And he is also, you know, a young gay man. So he's figuring all these things out together. But, you know, how does that fit in one person? And what does that mean? And what, you know, what is he going to do? And how is this all going to work? And while he loves his mother really doesn't have her shit together. You know, she's trying and she means well, but she made a questionable decision maybe when she was 16 or so. And it's affected, continues to affect him because they're almost more peers than parent and child.
And I love how you kind of connect this to, right, and because of who she is and because of her age, she was sort of coming of age in the 60s, so there's also this idea of what does that mean, right? What does that mean for young people? And we learn a bit as we go through. I think it's really fun to learn a bit more about Morrison and sort of how different elements of his life and his naming and who his mom kind of was, and that his mom kind of wants him to be like, at one point he's like, my mom just gives me condoms and I have to figure out where to place them around, you know, to place them around the neighborhood or place them in the bathroom. So his mom wants him to be something that he really isn't, you know, and so we see that struggle too with him and his mom. Yeah,
she's more afraid of him being a teenage father than she is herself being a mother.
Mm-hmm. And then we have our third sort of character. We have Sissy. So can you talk a little bit about her and bringing in part of this triad and what she kind of brings to this?
So Sissy is, you know, she's our villain, but at the same time, she's also a messed up kid. She's also lonely in her own way. And not saying that you necessarily have to like her, have sympathy for her at all, but just understand there may be a reason she is the way she is and why, you know, she was the start of the novel, because the real question I had, and she was the first character, was, and I started working on the book in 2016, at the very end of 2016. And I'm like, we see all these adult narcissists and we see the damage that they can do to other people when they have power. But what would a teenage narcissist look like? What would a narcissistic child look like compared to, you know, you might not see them for what they are. You might be able to go, oh, they're just a kid. But what could they do? What kind of damage could they do? Especially if some of the other characters were very vulnerable to that, or how would they be vulnerable? And so Sissy was the start of the novel, and just what would that kind of character do? And you know, how would she influence, or how could she harm or help in some cases these other more vulnerable characters who don't have as strong of a sense of self yet?
And I also thought that having her as a teenager was interesting, because we often have these, like I think of the bad seed or the good son, right? But it's often these, like, it's either small children or it is, like you're saying, it's adults who have this kind of narcissistic complex. So what happens when it is a teenager, when it isn't like this small child we can either write off as like horribly sadistic or not write off as horribly sadistic, right? But like thinking of that middle ground. So I appreciated that it wasn't, you know, that we were in this different space than we normally are.
And I also thought about it, and so often when we see that type of dynamic, We see it, you know, with someone in power, in a position of power, a boss, or we see a romantic relationship. But you often don't see this among friends. And sometimes those can be the most destructive of relationships because you're not looking for that same power dynamic.
And so to sort of get at this, I'm guessing, you know, you talk about it a little bit, like you had to sort of do some research, do some digging. So let's talk, there's two sort of different areas that I mean, there's probably multiple areas, but can we start with like that? What is it like? What did you feel you had to do to really be able to show this and to talk about this in some kind of meaningful ways or really connect and get to know who these characters are that are talking to you or you're creating?
I would spend a lot of time at 3 a.m. thinking about the characters, letting the characters talk, talking to the characters. And that would just happen night after night. It's happening right now on the one that I'm working on where, you know, I can't sleep. They just pop up and I start thinking about a small detail. And that's the characters kind of grew out that way. I also did more standard research. What does this type of abuse look like? What is the impact? I tried to listen to people who had the experience of being in those types of relationships. And so there's the component of figuring out, you know, a fictional character, and then what's the whole psychology behind some of this? So it was a combination. I mean, some of my research was also, well, I kind of remember this being on about this time. Let me go make sure that this TV show was on this time on a Tuesday night at this month of the year. I mean, it was kind of compulsive on the making sure my pop culture references were good. And my one editor at New Orleans called me out and he was like, MacGyver didn't debut for another 2 months. You got to change this. Okay.
I will say, I mean, anything, you know, because that's my coming of age spot. Like, so anything where it's like all these 80s pop culture references. And I will say I was very happy that in your zine you talked about Remington Steele and having a Remington Steele fan club. So I love those little like touches in there where it was like, yes, I remember sitting there and watching that. Or I have to tell you, brought me back to like getting the VCR, right? Often we read these things about like there's these pop culture references or like we think of Stranger Things or these nods to the 80s. But I loved this, like, I got my Walkman or we got the, like, I still, it's gone now, but the, you know, strip mall in my small hometown where I was so excited when we finally like joined the video rental store so I could rent, we could rent like the VCR, right? So there's those kind of bits in there that really connect us to the, like what it was like, you know, if you had a certain kind of childhood or if you lived in that space, it really connect us to that space in these fun kind of ways.
Yeah. I remember getting our first VCR. I was like maybe 13 or 14, somewhere in there. And I mean, if I traveled, it went with me. That's how much I loved that VCR.
Yes. And I remember, like, it reminded me of like sneaking over to my friend's house because her parents would rent any kind of movie and my parents would not rent any movie. And I was like, I was like, oh, the VCR, I miss that. Now my kids are just like, we can just watch it anytime we want. So there's that nostalgia piece. You also bring in, right? So we have these, going back to sort of the sexuality and sexual identity, one of the things that comes up is they go to a gay bar, these three, and they go a couple of times. And, you know, and I had this discussion with somebody who was researching the 80s and the 90s and talking about like how much AIDS has changed or even how we think about and talk about that. So can you talk about, because you could, there are ways they could have gone to the gay bar, but they go. And then one of the times they return, there is kind of this celebration of life for someone there. So could you kind of talk about some of those decisions and why you wanted to make sure that that was in the book?
Something I've talked about with my friends as well. And you think about, you know, gay bars previous to, you know, we still need safe spaces, but we don't need them like we did in the same way. And in the 80s, gay bars were also a community center. they were more than just, you know, dancing, drinking, hookup. They were also part of the community, especially community that was being devastated at that time. And in particularly, you know, I have it set, they, where they go, they're going to West Palm Beach. So it is, you know, in an urban area in South Florida where there would have been a lot of people dying at that time. And I didn't want to set the book at a time. That's one of my criticisms of things like Stranger Things is, you know, we get the Spielberg essence of the 80s, you know, where everything is shiny and kids have all this freedom and, you know, parents are just dumb. You know, there was a whole lot going on at that time. And what was going on, you know, with AIDS at that time, what was going on too, even just, you know, behind the scenes politically, it was a very tough time for a lot of marginalized groups and for people who, you know, didn't have any economic power. And I didn't want to set the book at that time without it being a more rounded look at the time. So yeah, the first time they go, it's all fun. It's a drag show. But the next time it is the celebration of life. And I also wanted to make, you know, one of the subtexts in all of that one scene too is we hear all these family values and here is, you know, the celebration of life and you know, the other young woman at the bar that night has just lost her father. How is never said exactly, but she is surrounded by people who want to provide that support and be those parents that she needs. Meanwhile, we've got these three kids, you know, in some cases from, you know, from conventional households who aren't getting the support they need at home. So I kind of wanted to talk a bit as, again, fathers come up, you know, throughout the novel and family and support. And so this was a moment to kind of give a nod to the ways family can look.
And I love, like you said, so fathers come up a lot and, you know, death comes up in multiple ways. And I have to say that, like, so Michelle's mother writes obituaries for a living. And I kind of love that in these ways. So could you, you know, so we've got like death kind of surrounding these families and these characters all different ways. So could you talk about that decision to like have her mother like write obituaries for a living?
Well, and part of it was just the, you know, she does write obituaries for the living. She's very much trying to give something back to the living, but she is incapable of dealing with her grief and the grief of her children. So there's the difference between death and these obituaries, but grief and really being able to manage or handle that. And at one point, Michelle says that she could give these other families what they needed, but they weren't getting what they needed at home. Much kind of in the way about, you know, the shoemaker and the shoemaker's children. I mean, it takes her a long time in the book to really come to terms with having lost her husband suddenly and come out of that grief and depression enough to be as present as they need her to be.
And one of the things you do, right, we talked, is move us, you know, between the 1980s and just 2001, right? You could have brought it all the way back to present day. And I don't know, like, did that connect to kind of thinking, like, why 15 years later, right? Like, was there something in there that just, was it just the characters just said, like, this is when we're going to go back? Or what was it about, what is it about that kind of time frame that you created?
I think there were a few different reasons. One, I wanted them far enough ahead in time, because as much as I didn't want a cell phone in the plot, in the 80s, I kind of needed one a little bit. So I didn't want to put them too far ahead because, like, wow, 20 years, that seems like she's been gone too long. But 10 years, you know, I don't know. 15 just kind of hit right. And it's also, it's June 2001. And I also wanted to set it before 9/11 as well, so that we kind of have it still this kind of before time, before everything will change again, you know, in the future for these characters. And I wanted to just kind of set it in that period.
And then, and also for readers, like, I think there's this intensity with it because you do, throughout the majority of the novel, move back and forth, right? We get past, we get present, we get past, we get present. Sometimes we stay in the past a little longer. We move back and forth. So we get a bit of, especially a bit of Michelle continually throughout. And so there's that tension there and that idea of like, what's going to happen? Like, you know, wanting, you know, part of wanting to know, like, okay, what all happened in the past, but then how is it unraveling with her in the present as she's starting to think about this past again?
And I was trying to have her figure it out, as obviously the readers are like, wait a minute, this kid's trouble, you need to get away. But unraveling the lies, I kind of wanted to have happen, have Michelle figure it out as the reader's figuring it out, going, wait a minute, this isn't right. And I'm hoping in some cases, as people were like, hey, this is really, oh, wait, no, I see. Okay, now it makes sense why they did these things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, right, and I appreciate that move between past and present. You start to see that, right? If we just read the whole, if we just got, here's everything that happened, here's what happened now, we wouldn't get that tension that we do get as readers as we move through it in these ways. So the other thing is, you have some nods in here to, you know, people you know or friends or that kind of thing, family. Was that something that you were like thinking intentionally? And if you don't, you know, and if people haven't read your zine or they don't know you, they might not know like this is what you're referencing. But was this intentional or was it one of those things where you went back and were like, how can I throw in Motley Crue or whomever it might be?
So most of them were, as I was writing, I'm like, oh yeah, she would totally have loved that book. And that's a really nice nod to my friend Jean. Or sitting at home, you know, watching Law and Order is just an ongoing kind of joke between AJ and I about, you know, we will message you. I'm in a hotel, Law and Order's on. Like, it's just kind of this thing for years. So it seemed right for that character to do that. The Motley Crue reference was a request. And that was from my son. And he wanted to make sure that I put a Motley Crue reference into the book.
Well, and like, so at one point there's, you know, issues with like cars and overheating and things that, you know, and even I think, you know, eating peanuts on the, you know, Florida, driving to Florida. And so some of it is this kind of real life. And I think you mentioned that the gay bar that you use was in reference to a bar you'd been to. So some of this was like sort of pulling from your experiences. And
yeah, in fact, the car doing all of that and trying to get to Florida was informed by a trip that I took in 1995, maybe six, probably 1995. And I attempted to drive my Subaru from Maryland to Florida, and it did not like that one bit. And I mean, that in fact, that trip was what inspired the name of my first zine. I was trying to fix this overheating, the coolant issue. My friend I was driving with, she made some joke about a slow leak. And that was the whole start of my first zine. I have taken trips and eaten boiled peanuts, and they are a delicious, terrible mess. You know, so there were certain things, and yeah, there was a bar in Pennsylvania that looked like it was on an unassuming, just residential street that you got inside and then you realized was much bigger on the inside than on the outside.
And much more fun. So let's just have to ask you also about the title, right? So it's Sinkhole, right? So we've got this novel, Sinkhole. So were you like, I do not come up with titles for anything very well. So did you start with this title? Was this like, how did the title come to you?
I didn't start with the title. I don't remember, maybe 6 months in. I don't remember exactly, but it was an aha, and this is it. Because it worked on multiple levels. And it just became that, and that was it.
Yes, and I will, because that's what I loved as reading the book, right? I loved the, like, seeing all the, like, yes, there were points where I was like, ah, it fits this way, right? And so I will say that, like, that's another thing I love about, like, this kind of suspensefulness of it, figuring out, like, we've got this book, it's called Sinkhole, like, why, and all the different references or all the different ways it can be part of that. What is, like, I'm trying to think of how I, are there other things about kind of these characters that really drew you in or that you wanted, well, even if it's some of those minor characters, right? So Michelle has a brother, there's this, was there anything else about like some of the minor characters that you were like, I really want to make sure that they are here to kind of help or support or show something?
The one that comes to mind first and foremost is Harry the dog. Harry the dog was never really part of my intention. I had just got to a point where I had written up to, you know, Michelle finally makes it home and Harry shows up. And I'm like, wait, I didn't have a place for a dog in here. Like, what do you, well, okay. All right, I'll just write you in. Come on. And I went, wait a minute, Michelle really needs this dog. This dog showed up, but he has a job to do here and he does it well. And he's the first thing she connects with because she has isolated herself so much. She's so, you know, disconnected. And she can't be because she's sitting alone with Harry and Harry's guiding her and helping her without her realizing it. So Harry showed up. He's one of the secondaries. And Rosie. Her brother's girlfriend is like the only one with common sense in the entire book. I mean, she's just like, what is wrong with you people? You just talk.
I love it because there is, right? Like through the whole thing, sometimes it's like, well, you could have just solved this by talking, but you get it, right? Like there's so many moments where if you're on the outside, you see it, but you know, you're like, I can't, for whatever reason, broach that. The time has passed, right? There's these things where you're like, I wouldn't have known that. So, yes, the idea of like, just come on, talk to one another. And you're like, somebody finally said it, like, but.
And I think too, in the beginning of a novel, we see Michelle's mother through Michelle's eyes. And mothers are very often not, you know, they're seen as this add-on to their kids, particularly I would say too, in many cases in a lot of 80s nostalgia, they're just kind of there to fill whatever role. It isn't until she comes home, she has adult eyes, she talks to her, she sees her mother as a full person. And we feel the weight of the grief and everything that this poor woman has been through that is kept at arm's length by a teenager. And I felt that was important to start showing her mother. We don't get to see her as a full person because we're seeing her through Michelle's eyes. We see her through adult Michelle's eyes towards the end. And we get more of her story and how everything falls apart so quickly and for no reason.
Right. And that idea that sometimes it does take getting a job, right? Moving out, like going to these spaces to realize, okay, what my parents had to do or what we could have or couldn't have is a lot more complicated when I'm in my 30s or, you know, or older than when I am 16 and I just want to like be able to not eat, you know, hungry man TV dinners or whatever, you know, it might be. So we kind of see this, that difference once we've experienced that, right? Once we kind of understand and can have those conversations.
And if her mother is, you know, it's implied that her mother's trying to keep, make things easier in her head for the kids and try to keep the grief off of them, she's also probably keeping the money worries off of them. She's not letting them know how hard she's struggling. She's not explaining why they're moving. It's fun that they're moving into this trailer and they're going to get to share a room. She's not explaining they had to leave the house because they couldn't afford to stay there. So again, you know, that trying to make things okay by pretending they are ends up creating a distorted view of what really was going on for children.
And I, one of the other things I really appreciated was that it's really hard to leave home. And especially if you are poor, right? Especially if you struggle, that you need to do something better than everybody else often. And often for people, that's athletics, right? But like, so Michelle's also a swimmer that comes through the whole thing. And I appreciate kind of her coach in some ways talking and just like, this is what's going to happen. Like sometimes it's a big push out that door. And it's also, and you show this throughout, it's a internal struggle a lot, I think, with the, especially young people who are like, is it okay for me to leave? Like, you know, should I be going out to college or should I be going out and doing this on my own? Or should I be staying home and being with my family? And so you see, so there's that kind of tension in there and discussion as well.
That was also part I wanted to talk about class a little bit. And the fact that, you know, because Michelle and Morrison are working poor, that so often when confronted with, you know, an opportunity or their automatic reaction is no, because that's, it just isn't possible. And the barriers there are barriers that they feel, that they just organically feel from being poor, and those they're just imposed naturally, that these things might not be open to them, might not be possible to them. These are worlds they haven't seen, or just they're not going to be able to do it. You know, when, and for Sissy, she can't see those barriers. She gets aggravated with them for seeing something she can't. And that is all part of Michelle's struggle too, with this, you know, college scholarship and how to, you know, how to want more without feeling like you're turning, that you're looking down on your family because you get caught in between having, you know, seeing that there might be more or something else you want and what you have and know without understanding the complexities of what your parents going through to get you there.
Mm-hmm. And these little, like, and throughout this, we see these little like nods to what that working poor, like, I'm going to, I can look at my money and I can afford to buy fries, right? Or I'm going to just slowly eat the Doritos and hope they last or whatever it might be, right? And also that tension between my, you know, my friend is really rich. My friend can gives me things that my family can't. And how do you kind of, and we kind of see how families feel too, that tension or feeling like they can't give to their children in the ways they want.
Right. And then, you know, Sissy's like, oh no, this is fine. This is fine. I'll pay for everything. And then she throws it in their faces constantly.
Right. Which is right. And that like, and so there's those little things that it's like, yep, that's a thing, right? Like I've seen that, we see that, right? You know, there was, I think in the point, at one point they were shopping and was she going to go buy Guess jeans? Like there was something where I was like, yep, I remember, because it was like, if you could tell who was really rich, because that's what they had, right? You know, they had this kind of jeans or that kind of, and so we're really kind of getting to see and feel that in some really authentic ways, I think. So you have, so tell us, so this, you debuted, this came out in March Yeah. Is that right?
No, May.
Or May? May? May. It's something with an M, right? So May. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit, like, are there things that you want to kind of promote? Are there things you're looking for? Do you want to sort of share, like, shout outs for what's going on with Sinkhole, if you're talking or available?
Just, you know, it came out in May. It came out much stronger than we were expecting. Like, I think all along we thought there was a really good chance of this kind of developing a bit of a following, maybe even a cult following, because it's not quite suspense. It's not quite coming of age, but I think that certain readers are just going to like it and connect with it. And that's what we've been hearing, but, got a really nice review in the New York Times, which kind of blew everything up for a few minutes. But now I'm kind of back to, you know, it's a lot of work to try to tell people about a debut novel from a small university press. And, you know, that's my job in this and trying to make sure that it finds readers. And that's a tough thing to do right now. And just the way things have changed in publishing, the way things have changed in media. And it's kind of a confusing time to, you know, I work in publishing by day too. And so I can kind of see this all happening, but then I have to apply all these changes to what I'm doing as well. And, just that, you know, I kind of want these characters to go out in the world and talk to people.
And there is an audio version coming mm-hmm. out. Is it out now or is it coming out? It's out. So there's an audio version. I know that some people love audio, so there's an audio version as well. But these characters, they're a lot of fun. And I will say, as a child of the 70s and a teen in the 80s, like, there were these I really appreciated, like, those moments of realness in there. Is what, you know, I'm like, yes, that's exactly how it was. And that suspense going back and forth, going, you know, like you were at one point, I think you said, like, you, the reader's figuring it out as she's kind of figuring it out. And it's there. And, you know, even though you're like, come on, don't you see it? You're like, that's why. So we got this, you're pushing this. Is there something else? I'll ask you my, like, question I most ask, like, is there anything else you're working on now? Anything you want to kind of put out there that is next on the docket?
There is. I started, a character started showing up and I couldn't quite tell if it would fit with the plot that I had kind of going on in the background. And I realized, nope. This is a different character, and this is, I have two different books. Okay. Book number three, you go over there for a while. And, book number two, the character keeps showing up at 3 a.m, which is how I know it's getting real. And I've started a spreadsheet. So I know that, I'm kind of on the road. What's nice this time is I know what my process is, so I don't have to figure that out. And I can jump ahead to plotting and character development without trying to, like, have all these false starts of how to write a novel. Yeah.
Which is always, I think, like, the trickiest part, right? How do we do it? How do I figure out my process? How do
I be doing this? Am I wasting my time? Why are you doing this? This is stupid. You're insane. Wait, no, this is interesting. Maybe it's okay. Yeah, no, I'm hoping that maybe I can shave a little bit of that back and forth self-doubt out this time.
Yes. But, you know, and then have fun with it, right? Have fun and enjoy your characters and these characters. And I'm guessing you're bringing in completely new characters, right? These characters are going to go out and do their own thing in the world.
they are completely new characters, although I really like Tana French and I like how she is able to loosely thread her world, usually by one character that links that you don't realize will be the main character in the next. So I'm debating doing a little bit of that. I had figured that out early on before I even got too far along. So I think I know what I'm going to do there.
And see, then there's opportunities. And then you keep everybody reading, guessing, right? Like, who's going to come? Who's going to come up next? Well, but so Davida, it's been really great talking to you about Sinkhole. You folks will be able to find your website and get the book at the local bookstores and get out there. And I'm guessing you can also order directly from University of New Orleans Press. I don't know if you have any local bookstores you want to give a shout out to that are carrying it in your area.
I'm a huge supporter of indie bookstores, so I have an entire list on my website. If you're in the Baltimore area, Atomic Books and Greedy Reads both carry it. There are a number more. I've gotten letters because I've been trying to talk to booksellers because that's what I do during the day. I mean, it's carried as far as Alaska, indie bookstores all the way. And even if you are into audio, indie bookstores can do that.
Yes. Yes. And usually for the same price, if not less, than some of the big conglomerations that, don't need it. So again, Davida, thank you, Davida Breyer, who is the author of Sinkhole, which is her debut novel, suspense and mystery and all that excitement. Thanks for being here with me for New Books in Popular Culture.
Thank you.